You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A jury last week awarded a California man with terminal cancer $289 million in a lawsuit against chemical giant Monsanto. The jury agreed with plaintiff Dwayne Johnson's claim that his exposure to the popular herbicide Roundup on the job and the main ingredient known as glyphosate resulted in his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. With over $250 million in punitive damages in this one case alone, the stakes are high for Monsanto's owner Bayer. So where does the legal fight go from here, even beyond this immediate case, which is likely to be appealed? Joining us now is someone who has experience in these issues. Richard Stevens is an internationally renowned cancer researcher at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine and has been writing about the trial and the legal fights that are likely to come for everyone from Salon to WBUR to The Conversation. He joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Joe. It's good to be here.
So I want to talk about the path forward in a moment, but first let's talk about the main issues at hand in this trial. Back in 2015, the WHO's International Agency for Research on Cancer weighed in on this issue and said that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen. You've worked with the IARC on a number of different occasions. How does this process work, and what does it mean that something is a probable human carcinogen based on their standard?
Well, probable means there's credible evidence, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. A class one carcinogen by the IARC is something like smoking or ionizing radiation, where the scientists feel there's no doubt that this agent can cause cancer.
So in this case, it's found in studies on laboratory animals. Is that the difference between this study that was undertaken by this international agency versus an epidemiological study on humans?
The way the IARC does this is they invite, for each agent that they evaluate, they invite about 25 scientists from around the world, and they call it the working group. And this includes about six or seven epidemiologists, six or seven toxicologists, and six or seven basic scientists. So the epidemiologists like me, we do observational studies in humans. Are smokers more likely to get lung cancer or not? Those are difficult studies to do. The toxicologists then give the chemical or whatever it is to rats and mice to see if they get cancer and what kind of cancer. And then the basic science is something like putting the chemical in a test tube and seeing if it damages DNA. So the process takes about 10 days for each agent that's evaluated, in this case glyphosate, in 2015. And they all come together, the toxicologists, epidemiologists, basic scientists, and they have to come to consensus. Do we think this is a proven, yes, it is a carcinogen or hazard, a cancer hazard, or is it a probable, that's a 2A, or a 2B is a possible? So there's a whole list of classifications.
So there's a spectrum then where these things fall based on the science of the day. Is that the type of thing that evolves over time?
Yes, it is. In fact, IARC reevaluates agents as new evidence comes along, as it should. Sometimes it upgrades, and sometimes it actually downgrades an agent.
And we'll talk about some of the history there in a moment. Now, there was other evidence presented in the trial. Specifically, this IARC study was controversial. The company, as one might expect, took issue with it. And there were other scientific studies that the company brought out that said, hey, this is not a carcinogen, or at least we haven't seen the type of evidence there. Is that unusual to have such a diversity in conclusions from different respects? Researchers?
No, that is not unusual. And in fact, I teach my students, and I believe this, and I talk to my other faculty members, I think that the way we do science is a lot like a trial and a jury trial, because we're presenting evidence to each other. We're trying to prove things. Well, what is proof? What does that mean? And I say this to my scientific colleagues, and they're very uncomfortable with it, but proof to me is a consensus of experts. That's all it is. It's all it can be. And so that means something that's been proven can be unproven by new experts and new evidence. So this jury and this trial, they were presented evidence very persuasively, evidently by the plaintiff's lawyers, and they came to the conclusion, as you said earlier, that that not only was Monsanto negligent, that was the compensatory damages of $39 million, but in addition, they did punitive damages of $250 million. That means that the jury believed that Monsanto deliberately suppressed or withheld information that glyphosate did cause cancer, withheld that information from the public.
And that came in the form of emails that were entered into evidence from Monsanto dating back a number of years, painting a less than sympathetic picture of how seriously the company treated this issue of health concerns. That's a different sort of thing than what scientists normally deal with, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, this is a matter of motive. Now, I have not seen those emails, and I cannot evaluate whether Monsanto did, in fact, cover something up. I don't know. But the idea of selective presentation of data, I shouldn't say this if my scientific colleagues are listening, it's not so pristine. We're doing our best, but we're human beings, too. And we all have biases as human beings. And I do my best to do objective science, but I do have things I would like to see. So you can, we try to avoid this, you can selectively present evidence. Now, the epidemiologic evidence, these are necessarily observational studies. We cannot do experiments in people. So we need, and the other thing that's really too bad is it's easy to do epidemiology badly. So you can have two studies that have very different conclusions. And this is part of the IARC's mandate, is to have experts really get into the nuts and bolts of these studies to see which ones are credible evidence, one way or the other.
How different is that than the legal system and the burden of proof there versus that scientific consensus that you're talking about? You have experience, you know, your groundbreaking research on breast cancer and how circadian rhythm disruptions and things like that have contributed to that disease is an example. How, in your experience, did it play out building that scientific consensus? Is there a lot of give and take between different researchers and pushback? I think there's a level of opaqueness from the public. We don't really know how this peer review process works. We don't understand it. It's maybe above our pay grade. How did it work in your experience?
Well, I think it's not that mystical a process. I mean, the scientific process and health and medicine, it's very much like this. Up until about 20 years ago, it had been proven that ulcers were caused by acid in the stomach. It had been proven. All the gastroenterologists and everybody said it was true. And then a guy came along named Barry Marshall, and he said, no, it's caused by a bacteria. And he was vilified. He's an MD, but he was just vilified. It can't be true. It's not possible. Turned out it was. And that's Helicobacter pylori. It's now been proven that it's the cause of ulcers and stomach cancer. And so it can be a long, hard process. In my own experience, there was a great deal of resistance to the idea that light at night, just turn on a light bulb. How could that hurt you? What's toxic about a light bulb? And then people started to think about this whole area is moving very fast, by the way, circadian biology. But a light bulb, if it's too bright in the evening, it's going to change your physiology back to daytime physiology, which cannot be good.
In the most recent piece that you published just within the last few hours, really, on this issue and the most recent judgment in this case against Monsanto, you looked at a couple of different case studies and offering different examples of how this might go, as this is certain to set off a lot more cases like this. Looking back at history, you cite two examples, the first being the asbestos industry and the Johns Manville Company. Tell me about that and how that wound up working out and making its way through the legal and scientific communities.
Well, it is a very interesting case because asbestos is a miracle product. It's just marvelous. It's so good at so many things. And it was very, very popular. And then it turned out that the epidemiologic studies, observational studies in people, found that the workers who were getting exposed to it, they got sick. They got real sick. They got mesothelioma, pleural lung cancer type of thing. And at first, the industry didn't want to hear that. The public didn't want to hear that because it's such a marvelous product. And then, but it became overwhelming, and it went through the courts, lots of litigation, and it bankrupted Johns Manville in 1982. Now, that's one side. Asbestos really is dangerous if you inhale it. But, you know, the dose makes the poison. We have things in our food. We add iron to a lot of our cereals. Iron, if you give iron to rats in sufficient quantity, it causes cancer. Iron is a potent prooxidant, but it's also an essential nutrient. So it's a matter of balance. But in the asbestos case, it bankrupted the company because it became clear it was a serious cancer hazard. But there still is asbestos in some products.
And then you paint another picture with a different product that also inspired product liability suits that wound up going the other way, and that's the artificial sweetener saccharin. How did the consensus change there, and what did it mean for that industry?
It was a similar thing. Saccharin was a miracle because especially people who were somewhat overweight, but they still wanted sweet drinks. They didn't want to put sugar in it, so they got this marvelous thing called saccharin. And this back in the 60s was invented back in the 19th century. And then some researchers in the early 70s gave saccharin to some mice and got some bladder cancers. And this really got a lot of publicity. And so the FDA and others were really wanted to ban saccharin. And there was a big public outcry. And then it sort of went the opposite direction. More research was done. It turned out that the particular bladder cancer in the rat was by a mechanism that can't happen in people. So these animal studies are important to do, but they're not human cancer. And so it may be one type of cancer in a rat that really has nothing to do with human cancer hazard. And then the epidemiologic studies the observational studies just did not see associations of intake of saccharin and cancer in general.
And so then the consensus reversed.
Yes.
How unusual is that?
Gosh, there's so many products. I mean, we have hundreds of new chemicals come on the market all the time. I don't think it's that unusual. I think these kinds of back and forth are happening all the time. That's why it's so tough for things like the Environmental Protection Agency and NIOSH, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, OSHA, for setting standards in the workplace and in the environment, and the FDA for food. What are you allowed to put in food and what not? It's a constant, important societal problem of cost versus benefit.
One of the other issues that came out in this trial, and it's not unique to this case at all, but it's when companies get involved with science and funding academic research and things like that. How good of a job do you think the research field is doing at policing itself and ensuring that there's transparency? There were allegations that in some cases there was ghostwriting of studies and things by Monsanto in this case. I know that you have put out the disclosure that you don't have any interest financially in any of the players in this and
right.
have been following that protocol, which many researchers do. But how good of a job do you think your colleagues do? And is this something that could be improved on, and if so, how?
Well, you mean in the scientific endeavor in general? There have been lots of scandals about eminent researchers either fudging data or working clandestinely with some industry or other. But it's a human enterprise. Again, we have these problems in every human enterprise. I think overall, biomedical science in America is very carefully done. And pretty well self-policed. There's a lot of big egos involved. And when somebody comes up with a new set of data, a lot of other people want to tear it apart. So that's true for the basic science as well as the clinical work and the epidemiology.
So those egos serve an important role, I guess.
Yes. It's a lot of sparring and jabbing and what have you.
Richard Stevens is a professor of the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, a groundbreaking cancer researcher, and has been doing some fascinating research on circadian disruption and the way it can cause changes in hormones relevant to breast cancer risk. He has been writing about the trial Johnson versus Monsanto. A jury awarded $289 million to the plaintiff in that case last week, suggesting that Mr. Johnson's cancer was caused by exposure to Monsanto's product Roundup, which contains the weed killer glyphosate. That is something that will continue to make its way through the legal system, both in this case, almost certain to be appealed, and likely other cases along those lines as well. You can find Mr. Stevens' article and others online at theconversation.com, as well as on Salon and WBUR. Mr. Stevens, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Joe. It was great to be here.